Maybe the Iraqis murdered him to rip off those guns to shoot up their satellite. You could link it in with this battle, but it's a sort of a mundane level. Because I like to concentrate on the software war, the image warfare of the media archetypes themselves. The hardware is, it used to be a phrase that money is the poor man's credit card. Well, hardware is the corporate archetype's credit card. You could say the old hardware corporate structures like the steel industry or the chemicals industry or the railway industry, any of those old hardware forms, that is their credit card. Right?
Of course, without any cash, what will that mean in terms of debit cards? There's a move by, I think, the bank, the TD Bank, wanted to bring in a cashless society.
Yeah.
So if you remove cash from society, what happens to the small guy, the common man, in this scenario?
Well, the small guy disappeared before that. That would just make it official. Now, I'll tell you something. On September 26th, this element about the cashless society is going to be talked about by the exes in a new way. Most people think the beast, the world government, is going to bring in a cashless society. Well, I'll tell you a secret. The oligarchs are moving back into cash. In other words, this cashless society fear is not the hidden ground anymore. Cash is king. And this is because the oligarchs realize that money is a media archetype that must be kept going to preserve their structure. So they are not the element that wants the cashless society. Another faction does. And that faction that does is bankrupt.
That's true.
So that, I'm just, that's just a teaser. I can't go into what the exes say, but that's a new twist that they're going to add, is the relationship to real power and the cashless society.
We should wrap up. We've got other callers and
only
a little bit of time.
Thanks. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, it's getting late, so I wanted to, as usual, the intensity of the phone calls tends to increase as the hour gets late, so we've got another caller on hold. Hello?
Okay.
Hi? We just missed them.
Please hang up.
Oh,
and
didn't hang on
call
long.
Again.
Okay.
Maybe they'll call back.
There it is.
Okay.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, it's me.
Hey, Tony.
How you doing?
Good.
For the denouement.
No, not really. But there's a couple of things about Iraq that I thought were interesting, okay?
Okay.
And the more I think about it, the more complicated it gets. So look at it. There's either an underlying political intelligence reason behind it, the manipulation of hidden groups.
Yeah.
That's one interpretation. I reject that right now because I find the others more interesting.
Which are?
Okay. There's a factual thing at the root of this, and that factual thing is less than a year old. And I've got good arguments to defend that. And the second thing, I've got corroborative stuff from the news you didn't bring in. And then the final point is two or three, but what's going to be done in this situation is what's going to educate, inform, and change the public in a very dynamic way, and everybody wants to be involved. And here's where some of the corroborative evidence comes in.
Well, what's the first point about the factual, or are you going to lead to that?
I'd rather leave it, because I obviously don't know the answer to it. I'm not an intelligence operative.
Oh, okay.
Okay. The African National Congress just determined that they would have a practical accord with the government very quickly and against the protests of many of their own left-side groupings.
Yeah.
That's very plain, happened in the last week, very quickly. There was squawks about it in the press. Those kind of squawks would normally be good for 3 or 4 weeks of 5 o'clock news, right?
Yeah.
They didn't even get 2 seconds. Benazir Bhutto in Pakistan has been just quite neatly dumped.
Yeah.
There's some kind of a little subtle shift going on back there.
Yeah.
Now, the Pakistan people are very proud of the fact that their variation, their practical interpretation of Islam, allows them to respect the woman. And Benazir Bhutto is a proven, accomplished, excellent functionary. She's got no problems. She's been abroad representing her country. I just forget them now, but in some pretty tricky negotiations where if they were really a bunch of male fascist pigs, they wouldn't have wanted her out there because there was military implications, right?
Yeah.
But she carried that off quite nicely not too long ago. So that's not the problem. Whatever the problem is, it's not that. But the Pakistanis are very accomplished and very successful right now. In practical modern terms, they're mostly all caught up in their homework. Militarily, economically, and socially, they're quite powerful. They stand between India and Afghanistan. They've been playing that off. They may want a little bit of slack to deal with India. That could be the future. But Egypt's the same way. So I see Egypt as very accomplished, is what I'm trying to say, because the Anwar Sadat is, in retrospect, is always going to be seen as one of the great men of this century, and even Menachem Begin is going to look good because he was able to be his friend. And, you know, Begin's not a slouch himself. So Egypt's got a lot of potential there. They took everything the Russians could give them and kicked the Russians out 25 years ago, right?
Yeah.
They're still friends with the Russians. So I see, when I consider these practical things, I see these shifts. You mentioned Oka and Bolsheviks. Well, you have to remember that Mackenzie King during the Second World War was a classical 1920s-style Rockefeller Bolshevik, eh?
Yep.
He talked to his dog. He did. Yep. Canadians don't like to remember that today. He kept on trying to deport Canadian-born Japanese right up until 1949, after the war was over. The guy was a rabid case of walking, talking fluff, you know?
Yeah.
And the more closely you look at him, the less you find anything in Canada to like. The only answer to that, really, is to understand that Canadians tolerated him. The Canadians were actually nice people. You know, at that time, it made sense for them to tolerate Mackenzie King because he wasn't any worse than a lot of other stuff, and he was harmless, you see? You could say the same thing about Mulroney today if you want to, in the sense that Canada's probably permanently in a position now where the only thing we really need in the Prime Minister's office is a piece of fluff, and that's not going to change for a long, long, long time. Trudeau was the radical who gave the illusion that he could change this, but of course, all he gave us was fluff. So what's the key to Kuwait? The idea that they're putting up their own Star Wars is not going to work, okay? Because Japan's going to put up a space shuttle that can fly out of the atmosphere. They said they would do that around New Year's of this year. They said they'd do it in a few years. They're going to do it. Japan said this week that their economy's going to be all right. Kuwait's not going to sink them. There was a comment on that today in the news. People said, wow, how can they say that? Well, they can say it because they know what's going on. The hardware threat, the space threat that Saddam Hussein offers is nothing unless it's connected with the gun, with biological warfare, or with something that's unknown, right?
Yeah.
So what he is he's physically a loose cannon. He's got this army which, in terms of called up proven soldiers at the present time, is now supposed to be the fourth army in the world. That's a position that the North Vietnamese had right after their conflict. Look at the end of the Vietnamese conflict. The Americans were having rebellions on their carriers among the pilots, and they're the right stuff. They're the best. They're the last people that are going to cave into discipline problems. And they were refusing to fly over Vietnam because you cannot fly in the face of the kind of anti-aircraft defenses that can be mounted if the Russians are giving it to you for free and if they're giving you something that they were building before 1970, right? So tell me exactly how the air war is going to work in the Middle East this time. The Israelis found out in the 1973 war that their own advanced air defenses were shooting down their own planes. That was in that book, this Something Circle, I told you about earlier this year. they also proved that by using AWACS and Star Wars, not really Star Wars, but massive computer interactive technology, computers on the ground, computers in their AWACS planes, computers in their fighter planes and their fighter bombers, and probably computers in their drones too. And they sent in drones, and the drones drew the bullets from the anti-aircraft defense, and second waves of drones, or else the AWACS, were able to pinpoint and locate the sources of the anti-aircraft fire. And then the fighter bombers that were already in motion in a three-dimensional, four-dimensional chess game in the sky, which were being flown by their own computers primarily, 3 or 4 seconds lag, and they're being flown by an AWACS computer. A couple more seconds lag, and the ground-based computer is changing the strategy constantly as they go, and they fly in at every height, every angle, high and low, and they blow out the ground base, right? So that was the Bekaa Valley when the Israelis knocked out about 90 Russian-built jets in 1 or 2 days.
Yeah.
But that did not really establish. That was when the Americans gave the AWACS to Saudi Arabia over the protests of their own right-wing people who had not been keeping up with this kind of stuff, right? They had to give the AWACS away just to break even. It didn't really change the two important points. You can't fly against modern ground-to-air defenses. You just can't do it. It's going to be because you play this massively computer-assisted three-dimensional chess. Now, what if we got in Vietnam? We had carpet bombing by B-52s. Anybody who read what happens when a B-52 lays a carpet knows what this is all about. Toronto could be eliminated in half a dozen passes with high explosives, right? You'd die of shock if you were living in Scoville, for heaven's sake. So why didn't it work? It didn't work because they were trying to drop it on human individuals in a jungle that they couldn't see, right? What have they got in Iraq and in Saudi Arabia? They've got vast stretches of uninhabited desert. They've got clear atmosphere above it. They've got Russian and American and probably European, but certainly Russian and American war satellites up there that can change their flight path, that can dip from 150 miles right down to 80, 90 miles, whatever, 70 miles if they need to, in order to get better pictures. So they've got a huge empty shooting gallery, right? Covered with empty atmosphere, no clouds above the North African desert, that's for sure. And they've got all the electronic information gathering that they need. They can photograph these guys taking a leak anytime, day or night. And they're just the idea that that they can fight, that Saddam Hussein can fight, is just not on.
Yeah.
It's just not on. And they've also, the Russians, incidentally, have even been given away their long-distance rocket technology to both Iran and Iraq. So both of these people know, both of these groups know what can be done with really good long-distance rockets loaded with high explosives and neutron bombs. It makes you really think, maybe it's neutron bombs or biological warfare. I'm not sure. I don't really believe this. But after you believe that this could happen, then start using the method of substitution. Say, okay, he told me what it is, but the only thing he's wrong about is the payload. Pretend they've got neutron bombs and pretend that they've got biological warfare, right? Now, later on, you're going to realize that's not what they've got, and you're going to spend your creative energy trying to think about what they have got, because they've got something going on there. But
they got the support of Bush.
No. Suppose that, and this is a very real prospect for the coming world, so the people need to be educated about it. In another 20, 30 years, we're going to have 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 big groups that are going to have all the electronic software and all the hardware that they need and stable economies. And this whole situation is tending to stabilize an economy. Nobody wants massive armies in the Middle East. The Israelis don't want it. Not so much them, but certainly the Egyptians don't want it. The Iraqis don't want it. The Pakistanis don't want it. And the Turks don't want it because they've all got massive armies. They saw the 73 war between Egypt and Israel. They saw the war between Iran and Iraq. They don't want it. So Saddam Hussein is a loose cannon. They gave him a little bit of slack so he could lurch out into the open and learn at first hand what massive armies are going to accomplish in that area. In order to believe that he's going to succeed, you have to believe that Afghanistan wants him to succeed, that Turkey wants him to succeed, that Egypt wants him to succeed, and that Iran wants him to succeed. And only after you believe that those four great powers want him to succeed can you believe for one split second that there's going to be a huge upwelling of Maslow fundamentalism, which is going to push this new Hitler to the fore. That's nonsense. Now, about 6 months ago, I pointed out to you there was a sudden flurry of activity in energy futures, gas out west, oil futures, and various other small energy futures, and it bugged me because I couldn't quite figure it out. The only thing that was going on at that same week was that Iraq did use something to push 40 pounds of hardware up into a low orbit, something like that. But that didn't really... They also mouthed off about dropping chemical weapons on Israel, and the Israelis jumped at that because they were very embarrassed and they looked very bad about the West Bank, and they still do. But they jumped at that one, and I thought to myself, well, that's just a wet dream for you guys. You just really wish that you did have an Iraqi Hitler, because it would allow the extreme right-wing factions in Israel to dominate unduly, which really nobody wants them to do, including most American Jews.
Here we got and 1 minute, so make your point.
Well, I guess my point is that all of this stuff is going to come out. Why does the ANC, for example, get on board with Gorbachev? Well, one thing about Gorbachev is they've got lots of grain and they've got lots of oil in the Soviet Union, and they've got lots of gold. So as long as the Russians can keep on staying on side with us in this kind of a thing and feeding us grain and oil and gold over the next 5 or 10 years, then it's going to prevent inflation in our economies, and it's going to give them the dollars that they need to buy microcircuits off the Japanese, and so on and so forth. And you see, it's really a stabilizing influence for the Russians. You could almost say the Russians should have pushed Saddam Hussein into it.
Okay, let's stop there. Thanks. That means Sykes on our way?
Could be.
Okay. So, thanks, Dublin.
That's it for Tony.
Thanks to... Don't say Tony. Thanks, Dublin. Always is an intense way to end the discussion. He always opens whole new vistas that gives us stuff to deal with over the next 2 weeks, and we'll continue this in 2 weeks. We certainly will be here. The final little megalomaniac point I want to make is that the coup in Trinidad and Tobago...
Yeah, we didn't talk about that at all.
Yeah, it happened 4 months after Bob and Connie had a vacation in that area. You can't say that Bob and Connie didn't have something to do with it because...
Ex-Ryerson student
from CKLN, or Associated Premises, and 22 people were killed. So on that fantastic point, Dublin, let's listen to our Tai Chi church hymn anthem. Take it away, Mike.
Okay, we'll be back in 2 weeks, the 22nd of August. As I said, that's our special show. Again, we'll do our Festival of the Swamps, where we connect with Madison, Wisconsin, and other parts of North America by phone. And that should be quite exciting and interesting. Church of the Subgenius, another two-hour segment. Log down, and here we are. See you in 2 weeks.
Hope you liked it.
Praise Bob.
I need some help. Why won't you let me love you? CKLN and the Garys are pleased to present The Return of Michelle Shocked, Thursday, August 9th at The Diamond.
Well, one of the dangers of traveling on your own, I think, especially if you're a woman, is that from time to time it's likely you're going to be picked up by the police.
Michelle Shocked is quickly becoming a singer of political importance, examining our social situations and relating them to us on a human level. Michelle Shocked will be backed by the legendary Tower of Power for a full night of big horns and political perspective. Michelle Shocked and her band, Tower of Power, Thursday, August 9th, the Diamond Club, 427 Sherbourne Street. Tickets are $20 and available through Ticketmaster, The Recapeller, Flip City, and The Diamond. The Return of Michelle Shocked, backed by the legendary Tower of Power. Thursday, August 9th, The Diamond, from the Garys and 88.1 CKLN.
Radio serving the greater Toronto community. There appears to be a split in CIA over Mideast and other policies. So one faction fingers the other. How? Well, their pals in the mass media suddenly run detailed stories of the other group's dirty work, such as that the intelligence agencies were implicated in the assassination of President Kennedy. Strange stories began running in the major papers in August 1990, just after Iraq invaded Kuwait, that a Texan says his dad was one of three who murdered Kennedy. Assassination researchers noticed a possible telltale signal. The story circulated just a few days after the anniversary of the murder of Marilyn Monroe. Now, the CIA press is always prepared to counter any article of CIA complicity in Dallas with items that the Kennedy brothers, Jack and Bobby, arranged to knock off their sex mate, Marilyn Monroe. So, the sarcastic public gets the idea that it's okay and patriotic for the CIA and the Secret Service and the military-industrial complex to kill the Kennedys, since, look at this, they were rotten people anyway. Funny thing, one of the biggest liars and hypocrites in the monopoly press, CBS anchor face Dan Rather, had the new JFK story on his network news. On that fatal day in Dallas, Dan was standing in the shadows of the railroad viaduct, just a few feet from one of the assassins firing from a storm sewer up near the railroad embankment. Dan was the only one on the planet to have the presidential limousine with the murdered president pass right under his nose. And by the way, can he say he didn't hear the shots from the other assassin right near him? In his book, The Camera Never Blinks, Dan Rather slyly sloughs off what he was doing there. As a reward from the high-level conspirators, Dan was made White House TV network reporter, later network anchor face at $2 million per year. Over the years, eyewitnesses have contended they saw shots being fired from behind the infamous grassy knoll and other places different from the official lie. Now, a document was revealed at a press conference linking the several assassination teams to the intelligence agencies, including CIA and Naval Intelligence. Again and again, the mother of Lee Harvey Oswald said he worked for Naval Intelligence. The press fakers called her a liar. Strange about the latest revelations, a top former CIA official also linked to Naval Intelligence denies the document is real, and a CIA spokesman denies the details. Usually, they are silent. Richard Nixon, once with Naval Intelligence, was part of a secret high-level assassination planning committee in the Dallas area just before the murder. Reportedly included was oil tycoon Murchison, J. Edgar Hoover, and various top military brass. At the time, the Murchison family owned the South Shore National Bank in Chicago. Was part of the conspiracy loot run through that bank and a meat packer here? Huh? Some think so. The bank, by the way, is now one of the only ones in the nation owned by a group of CIA-linked foundations. Some of these details are in the book not allowed to be sold in the United States by bookstores, called Farewell America, written under a pen name by the French secret police that infiltrated the plot and have been writing about it ever since. Recently released FBI documents show George Bush was part of a CIA effort after Dallas to cover up links to Cuban exiles. Playing again, the rotten past of Commonwealth Edison, owned by the Vatican, 731-1505.
Hello, this is Frank Zappa. You should be listening constantly to CKLM.
I think we need a little background on your career and how you first got into government work in the Kennedy administration.
Well, hello, Bob. How are you?
All right.
Things down here in Washington are still the same as when I was appointed by President Kennedy to the Export-Import Bank. Nothing has changed. Maybe it's gotten a little worse, but, you know, these things go in waves.
How, what kind of service had you done to draw Mr. Kennedy's attention?
Well, you know, I was a resident, really, of West Virginia, and I helped him and Bobby in their campaign down there in the primary. And they remembered that.
All right. Now, had you done any kind of intelligence work up to that point?
No, none whatsoever. It was only, well, I did represent some people in the company as a legal person here for them on their private affairs. And that was about it.
Well, did you have contacts with military people? I recall in one of your tapes you knew some colonel during the war, I think.
Oh, yes. That was intelligence work in Detroit.
Yes, but you weren't really employed in intelligence. You just knew these people.
No, I was in intelligence during the war.
Can you say why you got into intelligence at that during the war? Were you just lucky, or did you have a background that the attention was drawn to you to employ you there?
No, I had no background in intelligence. It seemed that Colonel O'Neill liked my work, and he offered me a job in another section. And I stayed there for about 3 years with the Army Air Corps.
And then that was until the end of the war?
That's right.
And then you pursued law?
Well, I was studying for law at that time, you see. And then when I graduated from law in 1951 here in Washington, George Washington University, I began to practice down in Southwest Washington, which is about 90% black. I took the Constitution down to the waterfront. And I did a lot of public service work for black people. But also down there, I found a lot of rich people. And I had gotten the fees from them and did a lot of free work for the blacks.
So you would you class yourself as a liberal?
No, I'm not a liberal. I'm liberal in social work, yes, but a conservative in economic affairs.
I see, but you had a basic sympathy for the poor of your of that period.
Oh, yes, because, you know, we go through these stages, and it's very important to go through them in order to provide a very good basis for your life.
Yes. Now, while working for Kennedy, what did you see something in your government work that prompted you to run for governor of West Virginia in 1968?
Well, the people down in West Virginia came to me and asked me to run. And, of course, I did consider it, but I wasn't very active in promoting it.